Welcome to Sense and Sustainability, your podcast channel for sustainable procurement. We hope you like what you hear. Please go to www.iso2400.org for more information, learning resources, tools, and much more.
Welcome to Sense and Sustainability, your podcast for sustainable procurement. I'm delighted today to welcome Richard Collins. Hi, Richard.
Good morning, Sean. Lovely to see you again.
Okay, thank you. So, Richard, would you like just to tell us a little bit about your background and how you became involved in sustainability?
Well, it's an odd journey. I think like most careers, you start off doing one thing and sometimes you meander through life and end up doing something else. But there is a connection. I trained as a branding consultant, and I often like to say when we talked about branding, because it was more of a tactical thing, we would say that your brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room. In other words, it's how other people assess your business, you know, whether it's your staff or your supply chain or your customers. And over the years, I've seen how brand language has started to focus more on responsibility around your social responsibilities and your environmental social responsibilities. And most of our clients traditionally were sustainable business clients. And we worked with the Green Organization, who run the Green Apple Awards for the built environment and architectural heritage. So the longest running environmental awards, continuous awards in the world. And over the years, we've seen this journey through how businesses are using their environmental and social credentials to engage their customers and to engage their staff. And I think we got to the point where I was keen to introduce the CSR Awards. So with the Green Organization, we launched the International CSR Excellence Awards about 10 years ago. And then, you know, I was running a branding business at the time. And then we were asked by a large business networking group to look at an accreditation for environmental and social responsibility, which we developed. And that now has become the more dominant area that we work in. So we transitioned to CSRA, incorporating the business about 6 years ago. So I've come from that branding background and I've, you know, moved through to where we are today.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think I'd be very interested in your views as well about greenwash, because we hear an awful lot. Yeah, we see a lot of brands now, don't we, claiming to be super green and energy efficient, and et cetera, et cetera. What are your thoughts on the way that we've moved on, as you say, from kind of having to do it for real compared to talking the talk?
Well, I think the thing is, pre-pandemic, this was a nice thing to do. A lot of the big corporates, you know, when my first job, ironically, was at BP in London in their head office during their late 80s rebranding. And, you know, organizations like BP are, you know, British Petroleum, as they were known then, are now, you know, referred to as Beyond Petroleum, because they're looking for that sustainable future. They're looking to be the energy providers, you know, within the renewable sector, you know, in the next 50, 100, you know, 200 years. I mean, this is the whole point about building long-term sustainable businesses. So I think what we've seen is, you know, these things being nice to do, maybe a box-ticking exercise. Yes, you can make claims. There was no scrutiny. So there was a huge opportunity for greenwashing, whether intentionally or not. But what I think we've seen, you know, in the post-pandemic landscape, it's a lot more scrutiny and there's a lot more regulation, a lot more mandated kind of requirements to record impact. So with net zero and your scope 1, 2, and 3 recording, and you know, the introduction of Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, which, you know, kicked off this year and will have an impact on UK businesses at some point. So I think the thing is that I like to think that people do this because it's the right thing to do. And a lot of organizations that we engage with do it for that. But there are now many drivers, from the staff engagement and retention thing to the mandatory requirement and regulatory requirements. But the important thing, and you mentioned the word greenwashing, is that we need to back everything up with evidence to support the claims we make. And there's already some regulation in the UK, the Green Claims Codes, that will fine businesses for making claims that they can't back up. So I think that ability to greenwash is closing down, especially as the internet and the digital domain that we occupy provides access to all of us to challenge what people are saying. If it's just a member of the public or a member of the staff or the supply chain or the government, whoever it is, I think there's a lot less room for us to say things we can't back up. It does go on, but you've probably been aware in the news in the last year, certainly high profile companies have been ousted for things that they're saying that they can't, you know, that can't be backed up.
So can you tell us a little more about your accreditation scheme? You described this movement from sort of branding to accreditation. How does it work?
So first of all, the challenge was to redefine CSR. We chose to use the letters corporate social, or the CSR, corporate social responsibility. But we did that on purpose because we wanted to redefine it for a new era. And we wanted the C to be an inclusive C. So we felt that social responsibility, our responsibility to the planet, to our people, was important. But the corporate bit was misleading. So we wanted the C to stand for company and community and charity. And actually, more importantly, collaboration, working together, to make positive impacts, because I think all small actions stack up and make big impacts. So the first thing was to challenge the C in CSR and redefine CSR for a new era. And then the second thing was to define a framework that was straightforward and common speaking. I've done a lot of work in the last year around navigating a complex sustainability landscape as we become inundated with anacronyms and initializations. So, when it's got the ISSB, the TCFD, CSR, ESG, it just goes on and on and on. And actually, the framework we developed was environment, workplace, community, and philanthropy. So, three pillars that all organizations can easily recognize. And I think the approach we wanted was a blank canvas approach. So, rather than us telling you what to do, we're asking you what you're already doing against those four pillars. In your language, on the premise that everybody is already doing something. So it's not a cold start. And I think that's the problem, is that businesses of all sizes are overwhelmed, with climate disaster and net zero and, diversity and inclusion requirements, all of these big things. They're big topics. But if we could create a framework in which businesses can see that they're doing more than they think they are, and that they can add to that, and that we can support them in the coming years on the sustainability journey that navigates them to a destination that's relevant to their business and their sector and where they are in the world. So I think it's a different approach, but it's one that is, very much carrot-led to start off with. By helping a business baseline what it's doing against those four pillars, we can see where the gaps are, and then we can help them, address those gaps and guide them into that complex landscape and provide some education, hopefully, around, what this all means.
So there's a lot of schemes out there, and you could say there's lots of kind of badges to earn, boxes to tick. How does yours vary from, if I look at things like GRI reporting, EcoVadis are out there with an accreditation scheme. There are, ISO standards, ISO 14001, ISO 26000, etc. Where does your service fit within that landscape?
Well, I think we're one of the only global accreditation schemes that looks at, the bigger holistic picture of sustainability. So those four pillars define, aspects of environment, of workplace, of, community engagement, and supporting the third sector. And we encourage businesses, if they've got ISOs or they've got an EcoVadis score, or they're doing it, that's part of the evidence that supports the accreditation that we provide. And I think the thing about our accreditation model is it's not about the badge, it's about the process. And what we say to our customers is that when you're accredited, that's the beginning of a journey, not the end. It's not, right, we've ticked that box, move on. It's right now we have a framework, we have a structure to work for. And then, you can then put into that the various ISOs or the very certifications that you may have. Because there's a lot out there, like you say, and within the environmental sector, there's loads of, marks and ticks and things you can get around environment. A little less, but they do exist within, the social value side of things and the workplace pillar. But then, with community and philanthropy, we wanted to make the distinction between community engagement, local economic investment and recruitment, supporting communities in that way, and then the idea of supporting charities through pro bono work or volunteering, and all of these link together. They all overlap. So it's, we're not the, I'm also a senior advisor to the UK's All Parties Parliamentary Group for ESG, and something we commonly say is you can't deliver the E without the S and the G. So it's, you know, in other words, you have to have structure in your business. GRI is a brilliant framework. It's a brilliant reporting framework. And so, you know, touching on the ESG, which is the mechanics in which the investment markets measure risk and opportunity, you have to have a framework in place, whether it's a CSR framework or social value framework, sustainability framework, it doesn't matter what you call it, it's something that you have in place that you can then use to kind of report the impacts that you're making. So I think our uniqueness is our approach. It's a process that's supported by training and social impact reporting and a consultation service as well.
So it feels like it's got a bigger picture than maybe some of the other schemes that we see. And your scheme is more of, I guess, an umbrella over some of those things. Would that be?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think what we've tapped into as well is that our focus is on people. So it's about how we engage people, how we create sustainable enablement and capacity building within organizations. It's all very well a company saying we've got a carbon reduction strategy, or we want to develop a carbon reduction strategy, but who's going to do it? You know, how is that going to be delivered? And I think, you know, whereas we feel that businesses should have a lead for their sustainability initiatives, sustainability should be part of all of our jobs. And if we can help businesses enable their staff, their people, and their customers and their supply chain and so on and so forth to contribute to that sustainable journey, then there's a better chance of getting it done, because it is about building capacity and showing that this is a true investment in future-proofing our sustainability futures for our business, not a cost, not a distraction. So it's absolutely critical. And I think, you know, to do that, we've got to have a bottom-up approach that has senior management endorsement and support.
Brilliant. And you've mentioned that the dreaded expression ESG a few times. That seems to be a thing now. You know, nobody was talking about ESG a couple of years ago. Is it any different to things that we've been talking about for years?
No, it's exactly the same, but it's the language that the global investment markets use. So environment, social and governance is the way that the world's, you know, investment markets will rate a business based on its performance and whether it provides a risk or an opportunity for investment. So it informs investment decisions. Now, unfortunately, it's leaked out a little bit. So it's now sort of, is ESG a framework? Is it a replacement for CSR, or is it a replacement for social value? You know, what is it? And the difficulty we have at the moment is that there are, you know, the global rating agencies that use, you know, ESG to rate businesses, but there's no equivalence around how they do that. And there's no regulation globally for ESG. Having said that, the EU did put together some EU-based regulation around ESG, which is the beginning point. I believe it's here forever, but I think it's in its infancy. And I think ultimately it's about accountability. So we might find that going forward that, you know, accountancy companies, you know, the financial markets will then start develop, you know, will become the auditors for not just for, you know, finance, but for non-financial reporting disclosures.
So yes, so it's not that much different, but obviously now the money is interested. The investor community is starting to become a lot more interested in this whole topic, ESG, as you say, net zero, CSR, call it what you will. There seems to me to have been a big groundswell in increased interest in the money. And also you mentioned earlier that you feel there's been quite a seismic shift post-COVID. How are you seeing that?
Well, I think if we look at the core drivers for, you know, environmental and social responsibility, for us, it starts off within the business. It's about a culture, and it's about having a business that people want to be part of. So it's building that purpose-driven culture within organizations. And I think what the pandemic did is it really exposed whether people were happy at work, whether they wanted to continue their careers, whether they felt they had value or purpose in their lives. And the thing is, as human beings, we care deeply about stuff, you know, from the Blue Planet to Black Lives Matter to Me Too and beyond. We care about environmental and social things, and we need our businesses to reflect that care. So to show that, you know, that they are listening to what matters to us. And that taps into mental health and well-being and diversity, inclusion, into apprenticeships, into supporting communities, all of these topics. So I think the beginning thing is, you know, the reason there's a heightened awareness around this is partly because it's about staff engagement and retention. A lot to do with the generational lens and a new generation of talent that insist that the businesses that they work for are responsible to their people and to the planet. So we have that as a very beginning point. But then beyond that is the reputation of the business, the brand reputation, it's the cost savings. And also when we get into the ESG agenda, it's about, I mean, you know, Virgin Money do sustainable linked loans, high street banks now look at sustainability in you know, awarding businesses with borrowing. We also have tendering, which can be weighted up to 30% with regards to environmental and social responsibility. So these are really bottom line commercial drivers. And then on top of that, you've got the emerging regulatory framework that is starting to mandate us. So, you know, the TCFD, which is now merged into the IFRS, which is S1 and S2, which is the non-financial reporting disclosure requirements for listed businesses. That sort of is, you know, sits with the CSRD and all these other frameworks that are coming into place that are putting pressure on businesses and supply chain. So if you look at the CSRD, it's initially about listed companies in the EU. But ultimately, that's going to leak out over the next 4 or 5 years to the supply chain, to parent companies. If you're manufacturers in Japan, for example, they will be mandated to report on their CSRD. So there's a mixture of, you know, culture and purpose-driven drivers, and then mandatory drivers and you know, good business practice drivers. But all of this is about building a better future and leaving a legacy for future generations. So there is that long-term sustainability piece as well.
So it feels like a perfect storm of drivers. It's interesting you say, you know, employees, you feel that the post-COVID shift is all about employees being a driver. And then, of course, as you say, the regulatory shift is happening anyway, the ESG agenda in the financial community. So it's all kind of coming together after COVID.
Yeah, I mean, I think COVID, you know, I know it seems a hackneyed old term, but I think COVID delivered a level playing field around this topic. So CSRA, we are global, and we're global because of COVID. We had no choice but to put our training online, and that exposed us to an international market. And now we've had for the last 18 months CSRA MENA. So we've been doing lots of work in the Gulf States. We launched this year CSRA North America, but prior to that, we have been accrediting companies, you know, in Africa and Asia and so on and so forth. Now, when we speak to those businesses, the most remarkable thing is pre-COVID, I think there would have been great cultural differences. But now it appears that all the concerns are the same. You know, it is about climate change and net zero. It is about scope reporting. It is about building a culture that's purpose driven. It is about brand reputation. You know, the language is similar. So I think COVID perhaps, you know, created that level playing field where everybody are at different stages of their sustainability journey, but everyone now is on this, you know, they've got the same view of how important this is. And I feel quite privileged in the role that I have, because I do see a lot of good. The great thing about environmental and social responsibility is it's a force for good, and it makes you feel good. So it provides that other important thing, which is a really important positive storytelling. It has to be backed up by evident story doing, but at the end of the day, it's good positive narrative in a world that is, you know, predominantly negative when it comes to its storytelling.
Yeah, I was going to come on to that. Obviously, you're in a very privileged position of seeing in depth a lot of organisations and what they're doing around CSR, ESG, whatever you want to call it. How are you seeing the trends? What do you see from your perspective?
Well, I mean, the trends, so it's interesting when we look at the sectors that are the ones who are coming through the accreditation. Obviously, the model is for micro businesses to businesses up to 10,000 employees, not beyond that. And the sweet spot sort of falls in the middle somewhere. And the dominant sectors are the construction industry, the built environment, and then law and finance, and then manufacturing and business services and so on and so forth. And I think what we start to see is we do see those change. I mean, that net zero is obviously a big topic. And with, you know, when we talk about drivers, there are organizations like the NHS now that look for a carbon reduction plan for their procurement platform. So businesses have to now think about what are we going to do in the next 5 years about reducing our carbon footprint, which taps into the net zero thing. But also we've started to see a lot more interest in the circular economy. So moving from, you know, just throwing stuff away to recycling, now to kind of repurposing and reusing and extending the life of products to extend the carbon footprints and so on and so forth. So we are seeing these different things emerge. I mean, sustainability is a constantly evolving thing. So therefore, it's never done. And that's the point, is that we want you, businesses to build a process that is part of their business strategy to address this ongoing evolution of sustainability. But and it's brilliant. And again, it's brilliantly innovative. In the last 6 months or so, we've seen a lot of huge development in green innovation, in especially in the construction industry. And I had the great privilege. I'm a member of the Institute for Sustainability and Corporate Responsibility. And a few weeks ago, it was Green Careers Week. And I had the privilege of talking to 500 year 7 to 9 students on careers in sustainability, and a captive audience. They hung on every word, it was amazing. And I felt that this is about a generation that is going to help businesses who are struggling to do something about this. They're going to come into the workplace and they're going to help change the dial.
Yeah, there really are careers in sustainability now, aren't there? I mean, that's something that didn't exist a few years ago. And certainly I'm seeing a lot of businesses and organisations. I mean, Chief Sustainability Officer is not, or Sustainability Director is not an unusual job title anymore. It seems that, organisations are waking up to the idea that they need a sustainability professional at the top table.
Yeah, it's like their finance officer or their, HR, director. I mean, this is somebody who's got to have a full sight of their business, and then obviously identify the individuals within the business that will support that, because it's not the role of one person, as I've mentioned before. It's about, sustainability being part of all of our jobs and being able to then report that. So when a company, for example, puts its application in, if they're of a certain size, they will go and talk to HR and finance and facilities. They need to bring the data in from the full business. And I think that's the great thing about the framework and the structure, is that often businesses are busy doing what they do. They don't have sight of the collective. And this brings it together and focuses it. And then actually, and hopefully what we'll see is CSR, ESG, social value, whatever you want to call it, will be reported at a board level, will become part of the annual the annual reporting and so on and so forth.
Brilliant. Final question for me, if I can, Richard. A lot of our audience are procurement people. What would your advice be to procurement people kind of struggling to get their heads around this agenda?
Well, I think the shape of procurement has changed, because there is more requirement now for businesses to buy products and services that have sustainability benefits. So if we think about that Scope 3 reporting, which is, the carbon, the greenhouse gas emissions that are connected with up and downstream, services. So whether you're buying in or selling, I think the thing is, you're required now to look at the sustainability of that product and service and report on it, because it's going to need to go at somewhere along the line. It will need to go into some sort of reporting. So what we've seen and again, it's phenomenal, but since Christmas even, we've seen a number of companies come to us, because what they were selling, the procurement departments were approaching them and saying, we want to buy this, and actually we want it, as cheap as we can get it, and so on and so forth. But now we recognize it now needs to deliver this level of performance, whether it's to do with paper or card or single use plastics or circular economy, whether it has to be reused, refurbished, repurposed or whatever. So we may have to pay a little bit more for it to satisfy those requirements. And I think that's what we're seeing, and I think from procurement, it's about questions. If you take models, for example, with the NHS, for example, a lot of stuff that they buy and will come through resellers. So it's empowering them with the language and the knowledge to ask for the right things. So as a customer, as a client, they may say, we want to buy these products and services, but now we need to show the sustainability aspect to that. So that education has to run through, through the reseller networks and the procurement networks and so on and so forth. So it's I think to reassure everybody as well who might be listening to this, this is not a race. It is a journey. We have time to do it. We have time to learn. We don't have to sort of panic and think, I've got to understand all this today. We have time. This will permeate through, and we have the ability kind of to learn the language and the benefits. So I think the thing is don't panic, but I think the final thing I would say on this is that one of the biggest benefits for sustainability is talking to each other. So getting out of that silo and actually engaging with your staff, engaging with your supply chain, engaging with your customers, engaging with your competitors, so talking about sustainability. What do you want What can we expect? What can we teach you? And I think that works all the way through the line. So certainly within supply chain.
So don't panic and collaborate. It sounds like a really good message to end on. Richard, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for your company and your perspective. I'm sure our audience will love it. Thank you.
And thank you for the opportunity. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast on Sense and Sustainability. Please listen out for more episodes. For more information, learning resources, tools, and much more content on sustainable procurement, go to www.iso2400.org.